Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. Iran says Tuesday's bombardment of Israel will not be repeated unless it's provoked. That's the sort of conditional declaration which has prompted the UN Secretary-General to tell an emergency meeting of its Security Council that each escalation in the Middle East crisis is serving as a pretext for the next one. Though Israel and Iran remain wary of the other side's strategy and potential, fighting has continued in Lebanon today between the Israeli Defence Forces and Hezbollah, the militia backed by the Iranians. Let's give you a flavour of events on what's been so far a less dramatic day than yesterday in the region, but one no less replete with danger. First to Lucy Williamson, who is in northern Israel. A day after the bombardment, I asked her a little earlier about the mood among Israelis.
Well, there was a bit of anxiety before this attack. I mean, you mentioned the war up here in the north. People up here are very used to having rockets come over the border every day. But this was seen as something different, something affecting the whole of the country where the stakes were higher, the scope was wider. But there's also, talking to people today just outside Tel Aviv, one of the sites where the Iranian missiles hit, where it actually landed, there's a growing sense of kind of weariness with the whole escalation, the whole situation that Israel's been living through for the last year or so. I spoke to the mayor of Hod HaSharon near Tel Aviv, and he said, look, people here have been living in such a surreal reality for the past year that it feels like every day brings something new that makes yesterday look sort of blasé, sort of normal, and people are just living that day to day, so they're reacting to it differently. In terms of what the government is saying today, I mean, you heard the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last night saying Iran has made a big mistake and will pay for it. He's been talking very tough, as you'd expect. His US ally, as you'd expect, still keen to avoid being dragged into a full-blown regional war. But Mr. Netanyahu hasn't been listening very closely to Washington recently. And when you speak to people here, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people who are echoing the calls of politicians and commentators urging him to really hit back hard and hit Iran in its strategic sites.
Lucy, thank you very much. Let's journey north to Beirut, the capital of Lebanon, and our correspondent Lina Sinjab. What's the mood on the ground there following this escalation? Have there been further attacks today, Lina?
Well, the southern border is really hot today with the further attacks by the Israelis on several towns, but also some clashes between Hezbollah and the Israelis who are advancing into southern Lebanon. Israel Defense Forces say 8 soldiers were killed, and Hezbollah also said that they have destroyed or attacked, 3 tanks. Of course, we can't confirm that because it's only coming from Hezbollah announcements, haven't been confirmed by the Israelis. But all this scenario is bringing to the minds of the Lebanese a similar situation that happened in 2006, where there was a full-fledged war between Hezbollah and Lebanon that lasted for 30 days. And that's the fear here, whether the people who are displaced or people who are still living in safety, they're all worried that things are going to escalate further, and worried about, Iran's attack into Israel if the Israelis are responding, will Lebanon be part of respond? These are all questions that are in people's mind day in, day out, while they're looking at south what's happening, and also worried about any imminent Israeli attack within Beirut itself or elsewhere in Lebanon, because the attack that Israeli is targeting today is not only bind to the south or to the southern suburb of Beirut where Hezbollah is based, but actually looking for any Hezbollah targets elsewhere in the city.
Lena, thank you very much. Well, in the United States, the State Department is responsible for foreign policy. Our correspondent there in Washington is Tom Bateman. Tom, given the fears about escalation, do you detect any pressure coming from the US State Department for ceasefire, some kind of attempt to pause the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah?
Well, not a ceasefire at the moment, although they would say that's still their policy, but we're clearly into a sharp cycle of escalation at the moment. So what the Americans are trying to do is limit that. And I think we're getting a bit more of a sense of what they are ruling in and ruling out when it comes to those discussions with the Israeli leadership in anticipation of an attack, a retaliatory attack by the Israelis on Iranian soil. Now, it's clear that the Americans are not going to be part of that militarily, but they are supporting that retaliation. So the question is then, what will it involve? Now, we know what is off limits because President Biden has been asked that directly in the last couple of hours, and that is any strike on Iranian nuclear facilities. President Biden said the answer is no. You know, the US is not going to back that in its discussions with Israel. Here at the State Department, we've then pressed the spokesman, Matthew Miller, on, you know, a bit more detail. Particularly, there are calls from some Republican senators, for example, saying that Israel should strike at Iran's oil production facilities. Now, Mr. Miller was asked about that, and he simply said it wouldn't be appropriate for him to comment on the detail of the discussion. But he went on to say it's clear that this was an unprecedented escalation by Iran, and Israel has the right to respond to it and, you know, continue to say they're having their discussions. So my sense really is that, first of all, it doesn't feel like the Israeli response is absolutely imminent, as in the coming hours, but the Americans are still urging a sense of restraint in trying to limit that cycle of escalation and then any further Iranian counterattack.
That's Tom Bateman, the BBC's UN State Department correspondent, talking to me from Washington. And we also heard from either side of the Lebanese-Israeli border, from Lena Sinjab in Beirut and from Lucy Williamson in northern Israel. Well, I mentioned the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres urging an end to tit-for-tat violence. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, Amir Saeed Erivani, also spoke at the UN Security Council's emergency meeting today. He defended the missile attack on Israel, saying Tehran had exercised its right of self-defense.
Diplomacy has repeatedly failed, as Israeli views restraint not as a gesture of goodwill, but as a weakness to exploit. Each act of restraint taken by Iran has only emboldened Israel to commit even greater crimes and more acts of aggression. Consequently, Iran's response was necessary to restore balance and deterrence.
Well, Sadegh Zibakalam, a professor of political science at Tehran University, has been critical in the past of his government. Was he surprised by its decision to attack Israel?
I was baffled. I was shocked. I was astonished, like many other Iranians. We thought that this will not happen because it's a very dangerous and it's a very risky step. Everyone is worried about the consequences of what might eventually take place between Iran and Israel, because we know that the moment that there is any confrontation between Iran and Israel, next second, United States would be at Iran's door, and the confrontation would not only be between Iran and Israel, but it will be between Iran and the United States. Iran's nuclear facilities would be the first target for Israel and for United States. Goodness knows where it might end up.
Well, that's Professor Sadegh Zibakalam in Tehran. Earlier, I spoke to Kelsey Davenport. Kelsey is Director for Non-Proliferation Policy at the organisation the Arms Control Association. And I began by asking her about Iran's nuclear capability and whether it's vulnerable to a potential attack from Israel.
Since the Trump administration withdrew the United States from the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has been expanding its nuclear program, and it's now on the threshold of nuclear weapons. And what that means, essentially, is that Tehran could produce enough weapons-grade nuclear material for, you know, 3 to 4 bombs in a matter of weeks. Now, actually weaponizing that material, building the explosive package would take longer, you know, perhaps 6 months. But that would likely be done at covert sites that would be more challenging to detect and disrupt. So the proliferation risk, the threat, is quite high and is very concerning.
Are those facilities quite well dispersed around the country?
Well, the facilities are dispersed, but several of the most critical facilities have been hardened against Israeli strikes. Iran has responded to past acts of Israeli sabotage against its nuclear program by moving its facilities to more hardened locations that are more difficult to strike. And that's really why a military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities would be dangerous, it would be an irresponsible escalation, and really counterproductive from a proliferation standpoint at this point. I mean, a strike might set Iran's program back, but the knowledge Iran has gained about building a weapon and producing fissile material, that cannot be bombed away. Iran will build its program back. It will build its program back at more hardened facilities, as it has in the past. And more concerningly, I would just say military strikes risk pushing Tehran to determine that nuclear weapons are necessary.
Right. So it could act as a kind of perverse incentive for them to accelerate the program and weaponize it. What about the possibility that to prevent that, America too, whatever it's saying in public, privately were to provide the nod or indeed the capacity to help Israel, assist Israel in such an attack? I mean, is it an attack that is simply not possible for Israel to carry out unless it has American equipment to do it with?
Well, it would depend on the scope of the attack that Israel is planning. If Israel wants to target the more hardened uranium enrichment facility at Fordo, it would likely need the largest conventional weapon that the United States has in its arsenal, the massive ordnance penetrator. The United States has never transferred that to Israel. Israel would also likely need U.S. refueling support if it were to conduct a large-scale operation. But there are other targets that are part of Iran's program that are not as well protected from a military perspective that Israel could damage, you know, in a solo strike. So Israel certainly has options, but a large-scale strike would really require U.S. support.
Many in the world consider Israel an undeclared nuclear weapons power. Does it have vulnerability?
Well, Israel possesses nuclear weapons, even though it has never declared that it has these weapons. And I think, you know, as we've seen in the Iran attacks on Israel, that Iran's ballistic missiles are capable of reaching Israel. You combine those ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads, and any system that gets through poses a threat. And that's why Israel is still vulnerable, and that's why we desperately need diplomacy to roll back Iran's nuclear program.
That's Kelsey Davenport, who is Director for Non-Proliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association. And just to give you a heads up, in about 10 minutes' time, we'll be hearing from former General David Petraeus, who also an ex-director of the CIA, on the risks and opportunities for Israel's military in attacking Iran. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Now, coming up.
307 years after it was sunk, we have found, without any shadow of a doubt, the San Jose Galleon.
El Galeón San José.
Ancient gold is dredged from the bottom of the ocean, but who should get their hands on the booty? Our headlines this hour. President Joe Biden has said the US does not support an attack by Israel on Iran's nuclear sites, while the UN Secretary General has warned of the danger of a regional war across the Middle East. Israel says 8 of its soldiers have been killed in fighting in southern Lebanon, where it's carrying out ground operations against Hezbollah. And the European Commission has said it wants to postpone a ban on the import of products which drive deforestation. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Coast Guards off the coast of Djibouti on the Horn of Africa are searching for more than 100 people who were forced to jump off their boat by the very people they'd paid to smuggle them across the water. 310 people were on board the vessel last night. At least 45 bodies have now been recovered. The International Organization for Migration, the IOM, a UN agency, says the death toll overnight makes 2024 the deadliest year on the migration route between East Africa and Yemen. Yvonne Ndege, the IOM spokesperson in the region, has been telling me what happened. First, though, I asked her to explain why Djibouti has become so important to those who make profit from the smuggling of people.
This migration route is known as the Eastern Route, and it runs from the Horn of Africa to Yemen and the Gulf. Predominantly, the migrants come from countries like Somalia and Ethiopia, and they hope to reach the Gulf nations, mainly in search of work. In order to do that, they have to pass through Djibouti, because these countries don't have direct access to the sea. And Djibouti obviously has a coastline. They cross the Gulf of Aden to Yemen and traverse through Yemen to try to reach the border with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which they hope to cross over to and then move into the Gulf countries. These migrants often leave their homelands. They spend weeks, in some cases months, on foot trying to reach Djibouti to make those crossings. And on the way, they are often targeted and exploited by people traffickers and smugglers, who they have to pay, obviously, to get them across to Yemen and onto the Gulf.
So these people will have paid to be given the vessels to get across the Gulf. But last night they were actually forced off precisely by the people who they'd paid to get them across.
It's highly likely that these migrants would have been forced to pay sums of money to reach, first of all, Yemen. But what we have found is that many migrants can't actually complete that journey, and they find themselves stuck in Yemen, sometimes for weeks, sometimes for months, and they have to pay traffickers and smugglers to try to return home. So this particular tragedy that we're talking about involves migrants who were trying to return, most likely to Djibouti, with the view of maybe later on try again to reach the Gulf, and in some cases to try to actually reach home.
What do you understand about what happened then last night?
According to survivors in Obok, which is just off the coast of Djibouti, and what those who survived and witnessed this tragedy say is that as these vessels, there were two vessels involved, were approaching the Djiboutian coast, in the middle of the water, the smugglers forced many of the migrants to disembark, to jump off the vessels. Subsequently, many of them could not swim, hence the tragedy, hence this death toll. There is massive overcrowding on many of these vessels. In previous tragedies, vessels have been about to sink or about to capsize, and migrants have been forced or pushed off these vessels.
So treating them like ballast rather than people.
Exactly. This incident that we're talking about marks the deadliest year for migrant sea crossings between the Horn of Africa to Yemen and the Gulf.
That is Yvonne Ndege from the International Organization for Migration. Now, a question dividing three nations. When ancient gold is dredged from the bottom of the ocean, who should get the booty? The salvage team? The empire whose wealth it was? The tribe which says the gold was stolen from it? Or the country off whose coastline the ship sank? Such is the thorny legal problem thrown up by the discovery of the Spanish galleon San Jose in the territorial waters off Colombia, being described as the world's most valuable shipwreck. Gideon Long has been exploring the vexed question of ownership.
Mind the gap, please.
This is Greenwich.
I'm in Greenwich in southeast London, famous, of course, for Greenwich Mean Time, or GMT, the standard used for setting clocks around the world, but famous also for its maritime history. Greenwich is home to Britain's National Maritime Museum, and I've come to see one painting in particular.
I'm Simon Stevens. I'm curator of the Ship Model and Boat Collection. So we're looking at a really nice oil painting on canvas showing the action of Admiral Wager against the Spanish treasure fleet in 1708.
Right.
And in the centre of the picture, you've got Wager's ship firing guns at the San Jose, which was laden with gold, silver, jewels. And then you've got fire and explosion on the left-hand side.
It's a really dramatic painting, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the masts are being blown away. The ship is heeling over, i.e. it's on its side.
And as I understand it, the idea was not initially to blow up and destroy the San Jose.
No, far from it. I mean, what you really want to do with a ship that's laden with booty like this or treasure is you want to disable it.
So it didn't quite work out that way?
Not really, no. I mean, unfortunately, during the action, a cannonball went into the powder magazines of the San Jose and it blew up.
Right.
And within minutes, it sank to the bottom of the sea.
And there it lay on the seabed of the Caribbean for the next 300 years.
Until the 1980s, when a US salvage company, these days called Sea Search Armada, said it had found the wreck. It tried to persuade the Colombians to go into partnership to bring up the treasure and split the proceeds. But the two sides couldn't agree on who should get what share and plunged into a legal battle that's still going on. Then in 2015, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos made a stunning announcement.
307 años después de su hundimiento,
307 years after it was sunk, we have found, without any shadow of a doubt, the San Jose galleon.
El galeón San José.
Santos said the Colombians had found the wreck independently of the Americans on a different bit of the seabed. The news made headlines around the world.
Treasure hunters have called it the holy grail of shipwrecks, and now it's been found. Colombia says it has located the Spanish galleon San Jose and its cargo, sunken treasure that could be worth billions. Now the Colombian and Spanish governments, as well as a U.S. salvage company, are fighting over who has legal claim to all that loot.
As that CBS news report makes clear, Spain was now also involved. This was, after all, a Spanish ship. So, Spain, Colombia, the U.S. salvage company, all staking a claim to the San Jose. And then, just to complicate matters further, enter Bolivia. A Bolivian indigenous people, the Jara Jara Nation, staked their claim to the treasure of the San Jose. They argued that this isn't Spanish treasure, it was stolen from their lands by the Spanish. Samuel Flores is a representative of the Jara Jara.
This cargo belongs to the Jara Jara people, the silver, the gold, and we think it should be raised from the seabed to stop treasure hunters looking into it. The money should be returned to us.
But what exactly is that treasure? What's down there on the seabed? To find out more, I spoke to Carla Rahn Phillips. She's a historian who's written a book about the San Jose. I asked her what the treasure would be worth these days.
I try to resist giving present day estimates of anything. If you're talking about gold and silver coins, do we make an estimate based on the weight of the gold now and what gold would go for now on the market? Or do we look at what collectors might pay for these gold coins? The estimates of the treasure hunters are just, to me, they're laughable.
And if the treasure is ever brought to the surface, who will get to keep it?
It's a difficult, if not impossible, task to try to satisfy everyone. I don't think that can happen.
That's Carla Rahn Phillips talking to the BBC's Gideon Long. His full report is on Business Daily on BBC Sounds, or indeed wherever you go for your choice of podcasts. Do stay with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, a mystery that begins with moths. One dead, one dying, and ends with a pair of much-travelled boots. Daisy Cadet, an ecologist by profession, spotted the insects at home in Wales and, fascinated by their translucent wings, she posted photos of her house guests on social media. That set off a hunt for the origin of this previously unknown species, a journey which began 7,000 kilometres from Daisy's home and which ended weeks later at the world-renowned Natural History Museum in London.
This was back in February when I noticed on the windowsill this quite distinctive moth. It looks like a little wasp, but it has clear wings. Next to it was a dead one. I kind of know a little bit about UK moths and things. I'm no expert at all, but I knew that it was a clear wing, so it was kind of uncommon and a bit special. I got quite excited about it. I took lots of pictures of it and I put it on Instagram, and that was when one of my followers, Graham Davis, who knows quite a lot about moths in the UK, noticed that this was something not as normal as I thought it would be. I had put the moths in a container because I was so excited to find this, thinking it was a UK species anyway. My plan was to just take some pictures of them, but Graham had been in contact with a couple of his contacts who knew a lot more about moths and butterflies in the UK, one of them being the contact at the Natural History Museum. And I ended up getting on the train and taking these two moths down to London and meeting the scientists.
How excited were they?
They were very, very excited. Within the day, they had kind of narrowed it down to a group of moths that you find in the Mediterranean region. So there was the possibility that it had come over on some houseplants, or I had been to Spain last year, so it could have been that. But there was no exact match. So after that, there was no confirmed species. So then the next step would be to get the DNA analysed. And then the email comes through that there's a match to, it was about 80%, 90% match to a South American genus of moth, at which point when we're reading this, it's like, oh, okay, connecting the dots a little bit here. I think we know. My mum had been to Guyana. So once we had this information that it must have come from South America, we were thinking, okay, right. And so at this point, we began the search through all of her bags. So as we're going through everything, we get to the boot bag, and this was kind of like the eureka moment. And okay, it's quite muddy, there's a lot of debris in here, and then I find a chunk of wood. It was like a piece of wood, and this piece of wood had two little holes, which is like, right. It was just absolutely insane, and the chances of all of these things happening, the odds that somebody would see the story of the moth on my Instagram, just everything.
Daisy Cadet, the discoverer of a new species of moth. You are listening to NewsHour from the BBC with me, Sean Lay. Now, earlier in the programme, I talked about what the UN Secretary General today called tit-for-tat provocation. Speaking at an emergency meeting of the Security Council in New York, Antonio Guterres condemned the Iranian missile attack on Israel on Tuesday night. He warned that the fires already burning around the region risked becoming a wider conflagration.
It's high time to stop the sickening cycle of escalation after escalation
that is leading the people of the Middle East straight over the cliff. Each escalation has served as a pretext for the next, and we cannot look away from systematic violations of international humanitarian law. This deadly cycle of tit-for-tat violence must stop. Time is running out.
Well, according to the Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister, 1.2 million people have been displaced so far by Israel's attacks in Lebanon. There are many refugees from the Syrian war in the country, and some of them have now decided to go home. Gonzalo Vargas Llosa, the UNHCR representative for Syria, described the scene at the border between the two countries.
Now more than 130,000 persons have crossed, fleeing the bombing in Lebanon into Syria to seek refuge from the airstrikes and violence. This is a terribly sad illustration of the excruciatingly difficult decisions that people are having to make. So they have the choice between staying in Lebanon, where they are being bombed, or crossing to a country that has been undergoing, its own war now for 13 years. It is true that it is largely localized, but the violence is still there.
Other countries have been arranging charter flights out of Lebanon for their nationals. This British citizen told the BBC about her efforts to try to leave earlier today.
I feel so guilty leaving friends and that are here that can't leave. I feel guilty leaving just everyone, and I'm really sad that I have to leave this beautiful, beautiful place. Things have escalated so unbelievably much in the past week. You can't sleep because you can hear the Israeli drones over your head. You wake up in the night because you hear strikes, or you get a news alert saying that there's been a strike. It's not a nice way to live.
The weakening of Hezbollah's capacity to attack civilians in Israel from their bases in Lebanon has created an opportunity Israel may find too tempting to ignore, one of neutralising its principal regional rival, Iran. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and members of his security cabinet convened underground in a bunker on Tuesday night and there agreed that they would respond to Iran's attack. How and when, though, would be the subject of negotiations, both military and political, inside the country and with its principal sponsor, the United States. David Petraeus is a retired US Army general. He's also a former director of the CIA. And when we spoke earlier, I asked him first to set out, as he sees them, the opportunities and risks facing Israel's military, including the possibility of creating a buffer zone inside Lebanon and whether that's achievable.
Well, of course, to have a true buffer zone, Israel would have to not just destroy the forces that are there now. And this zone would presumably be between the northern Israel border and the Litani River, which is roughly 20 miles or so north of that border. And this is from which the Hezbollah forces have been launching an awful lot of the rockets. So the current plan, as I understand it, is to conduct robust raids into that area to destroy Hezbollah infrastructure, degrade or destroy those forces. But of course, if you withdraw, there is a possibility that they could reconstitute. In fact, that really leads us to talk about Gaza. We're almost at the first anniversary of 10/7, and that response still is incomplete. Yeah. Israel has degraded very, very substantially the Hamas military capabilities. They have taken over control of the Philadelphia Quarter, the southern border between Gaza and Egypt, under which the tunnels used to run that allowed the provision of arms, ammunition, and other military material to Hamas. And as long as they're closed, very difficult for Hamas to reconstitute that component. And the dilemma here is that unless security is established, and I fear that only Israel can establish that security, unless that is the case, you cannot prevent Hamas from reconstituting. You can't prevent criminal gangs from essentially running the territory together with Hamas.
So there may be some, to put it crudely, PR benefit from the fact we're all talking about Lebanon and Hezbollah right now and kind of not talking about Gaza. But in practical terms, are you saying there's a bit of a risk for Israel in that if it diverts its military operation and focuses on Hezbollah, it may actually be giving Hamas breathing space in Gaza?
I'm not sure I would go that far. I'd just say that the mission in Gaza is incomplete. The Minister of Defense of Israel has publicly called for a vision for the future of Gaza. But without establishing security, you obviously cannot establish governance. You can't provide humanitarian assistance in an organized fashion without it being hijacked by criminals. The challenge for Israel here is that the Israelis have a small standing force. This would mean that they'd have to call reserves back up again for this. But it is something I think that is going to need to be done. This is a little bit similar to what we did during the surge in Iraq. Prior to the surge, we were conducting clear and leave operations. They would reduce violence, but within a matter of weeks or months, those forces, the enemy forces, would reconstitute. Now, this is different because Israel has Gaza hermetically sealed. So you're not going to see the resumption of support by Iran of, again, weapons, ammunition, explosives, and other materiel. But it is largely an ungoverned space, and in those kinds of spaces, the guys with the remaining guns are going to hold sway. Suggested, in fact, to the Minister of Defense that you start in the north, you come a mile in, do a wall east-west, couple north-south walls, you create gated communities. This is what we did during the surge when we transitioned from clear and leave to clear and hold and build.
Let me ask you about Iran and Afshan, an area where we believe quite a lot of nuclear facilities and nuclear activities underway by the Iranians. It says for civil purposes. Its critics, including Israel, suggest it may have a more sinister, potentially military aspect to it. What are the risks for Israel of considering further bombardments of Iran, particularly that part of Iran? Because there are those voices in Israel, you'll be well aware of them, who say this is an opportunity to prevent Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon or being able to have that potential to join the small club of nuclear nations.
Well, this is the central question, I'm sure, that is being discussed in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, whether to include nuclear sites on the target list. I tend to think not, but I think it's a very, very close call because there are indeed, as you know, there are those that are saying this is a golden opportunity to chip away at that structure. The problem with that is that there is no way that they would conduct the campaign that's going to destroy the entire nuclear program. In fact, it's publicly known that they cannot penetrate the deeply buried site in the mountain at Fordo. I think it's a golden opportunity to do a lot of damage to military bases, infrastructure, other missile sites, target those sites that have been making life difficult for Israel.
Washington has a role in all of this, not least because it's leading some of the military support to Israel. It also supplies weapons. How do you think it should be using whatever influence it still has and whatever potential it has in supply terms to affect the military operation Israel conducts?
Look, I think we should have candid dialogue with our Israeli counterparts. I have not always seen eye to eye, but that relationship is absolutely rock solid. I think we should provide them everything we can, everything they need, and then let them make the decision. This is about their survival, about their independence, their existence.
Sure, but it's also about the security of the rest of the region, isn't it? It's not just about Israel. This is hugely important for America, regards Israel as one of its most important allies, but it has to consider its other allies in the region, the Arab nations, and also its aspirations for the Palestinians, presumably.
It certainly does. I think I'm on fairly solid ground that there are a few tears being shed in capitals in the Gulf states over the demise of Hassan Nasrallah. Those who are saying, well, there are civilian casualties in southern Lebanon, those need to be laid at the feet of Hassan Nasrallah, who has terrorized northern Israel for the past year.
The former CIA director, David Petraeus, one of Sudan's most senior generals, has told the BBC the Sudanese armed forces remain determined to inflict a defeat on their military rival, the RSF, despite international attempts to broker a ceasefire. 17 months into a civil war which has displaced hundreds of thousands of people inside and outside its borders, Lieutenant General Ibrahim Jabir, the assistant commander-in-chief, has been speaking to the BBC's East Africa correspondent, Barbara Platasha.
We are very keen about peace. And the good and safe life of Sudanese is our first priority.
So what is the strategy? Do you think now that you're on the offensive in Khartoum, now is the time for war at this point?
We are not talking about war. No, we are talking about there is a certain thing that the Sudanese army must do for the Sudanese people. So how can you leave the Sudanese people fleeing out as a IDPs and the houses are 100% was occupied by the militia? Second, how about the facilities? Electricity facilities, all these things are now occupied by the militia. So how come? That means You have to fight them.
But what does all this mean for the chances of peace talks?
Peace talks can go, but the army will not stop for the peace talk to come in.
The UN says the army is still not doing enough to get aid into the RSF-controlled areas. There's still restrictions. The process is still taking too long.
Sudan government has nothing to do with the aid. As a Sudanese, you have to get your foot.
So you're saying there's no issue with taking aid into RSF-controlled territory?
No issue like that one.
So just to be clear, you're saying that there's no famine?
Sudan, it is not facing famine.
The UN has said that there is a famine in parts of Darfur, especially in the Zamzam camp. So you're saying the UN is wrong?
So you know Zamzam, it is encircled. And who is encircling Zamzam? This is a question. Let us answer.
The army and others have accused the United Arab Emirates of supplying the RSF with weapons. How much of a difference does that make? How big a factor is that in the way this war is playing out?
It was proven by the experts' report. It shows this is number one on ground also, on the field also. There are so many 4x4 cars, armored vehicles, passport, and some small arms, ammunition. This is make very big difference. Yeah, it's a militia. If you support them, it's with arms. But by the end of the day, they will not conquer. It's a militia.
The UN has said that weapons are not only coming in from the United Arab Emirates, but also from other countries, from Russia, from Iran. Are you getting weapons from Iran?
Clearly, and I'm going to tell you, you can find the weapons if you have money. And second, you can have weapons also if you have some facilitation of payment. You are a government and you have a right to deal with everybody.
The UN has accused the RSF of committing atrocities, but it also says that the army is carrying out war crimes, indiscriminate bombing, arbitrary detention and torture, strikes on hospitals and schools. How do you respond to that?
The Sudanese army, they are not angels. They are not angels. They can commit crimes, no problem. But it's individually. They condemn RSF and then they condemn SAF. No. We have the right, and we are working as a professional army, protecting our people and our country. We are completely committed to what I've told you about the Geneva Protocol laws.
How long do you think this war will go on?
It will go on until we control all the country in terms of security and everything and let all the IDPs go their homes. Sudan will conquer. Us will conquer and Sudan will be rebuilt.
General Ibrahim Jibir speaking to Barbara Platasha for NewsHour. This is Sean Lay with News Out live from the BBC in London. The US President Joe Biden is in the state of North Carolina inspecting the damage from Hurricane Helene. Almost a week after it first made landfall in Florida, Helene has wreaked havoc across the southeast of the United States. More than 160 people are known to have died. Some communities have seen the place they call home all but wiped from the map. One is, or perhaps I should say was, Chimney Rock in the Appalachians. Peter O'Leary, the village mayor who was on vacation when the storm struck, joins us live on NewsHour. Mr. O'Leary, it's obviously a very tough time for your community. How badly affected is Chimney Rock Village?
Well, Chimney Rock Village is like you mentioned, it's devastated. And it's, there is a good portion of the village actually that's still standing, but everyone has left. The business district has been affected 100%. So it's and we've got businesses that have disappeared, no longer here. And so you are correct in saying that it's not here because the business district is, you know, completely damaged and or devastated.
And heartbreaking, I should imagine, for people who live there because you'd spent so much time, effort and money building and developing the community in order to ensure its survival.
Chimney Rock's a small tourist village and there's no big business here. It's all mom and pops. And, you're absolutely right. Everybody that starts a business here, they do everything themselves. They sweep the floors, run the register, you know, restock the shelves. And so they put a lot of effort into it, a lot of just physical labor, and you know they all have to do it themselves. So yeah, they've put their whole heart and soul into it, and now it's gone.
What's the scene as it is now? I gather you're standing close to the river.
I am actually at our fire department, which kind of is up on the hill looking
right
down on the river. And the river, I struggle to say this, but it's kind of a beautiful sight in the sense that it's this big, wide riverbed. But what's terrifying is that it used to be five times smaller than that. And so you realize that where that huge new riverbed is, there used to be shops and homes, and a lot of them are gone.
What support has Chimney Rock had?
We've had tremendous support from search and rescue and debris cleanup and that sort of thing. But that's just getting started, and some of it, like the search and rescue and that kind of thing, is winding down. We've had to evacuate a lot of people. So as far as the personal, getting people out of the danger area and supporting them, getting them food and water, it's been very good. The real issue now is going forward is how do we return to some sense of normalcy, which I have to say will never happen, because the old Chimney Rock, if anybody who's been here, it is true, the old Chimney Rock is gone. It is totally gone. So going forward, what will Chimney Rock look like? It's going to be different. It's going to be totally different.
Peter O'Leary, Mayor of Chimney Rock Village in North Carolina. Thank you. Across the state, trees were uprooted, bridges collapsed, and the interstate, the major road network with neighbouring states, was shut. That presented a major challenge for David Jones. He lives in North Carolina, the other side of a mountain from Tennessee, where his daughter was getting married at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning. On Friday began what should have been a leisurely two-hour drive, but the father of the bride ended up on foot, as he's been telling NewsHour.
30 minutes into the drive is when I encountered the stopped traffic on the interstate highway. So about 7 hours later, after many detours and back roads and getting held up and delayed, I reached a point where they were shuttling all cars off the road and not letting anyone proceed further. I spoke to a state trooper and I said, I need to get to Johnson City. And he said, I'm sorry, sir, the road is out. The bridges, three in that area that were completely washed out. There was one in the town of Irwin that was not washed out, but they were worried about its stability. So no taking the highway, no taking the back roads. And I said, what about on foot? And he said, sir, please just go back to your car, spend the night there, and maybe in the morning we can open some roads and you can get on through. I couldn't place my hopes on a maybe. So when they turned around, I started off on foot with a backpack. I grabbed my shaving kit, a couple of changes of underwear and socks, and my cell phone for its flashlight, and I went on down the old back road.
So you had 9 hours and to cover what sort of distance?
It ended up being 27 miles. There were some sections of road that were just fine. There are some hilly sections, and there were some sections that were completely washed out, debris piled everywhere. At one point, there was debris blocking the road. It was 6 or 7 feet high. I got stuck in the mud. I finally was able to free myself from the mud and actually crawl under that one pile and through it and under to get to the other side. And eventually, I found the bridge that had not been washed out. From there on, it was just pretty much a hike. And then a few miles further up the road, a gentleman pulled out in a white pickup truck and he said, hey, would you like a ride? And when he picked me up, I had done about 17 miles on foot. We have a show here in the States called Survivor. So this was sort of like Survivor meet Hurricane Helene meet Elizabeth's dad on her wedding day. And I was able to make it, and I walked my daughter down the aisle at 11 o'clock that morning.
What did your daughter say?
When I got there, I told a few of the family, don't tell Elizabeth before the wedding. Don't upset her on her day. Along the way, I picked up one of those reflectors to sort of wave at the traffic to sort of warn them. So when we got to the reception, they had asked me to, as the father of the bride, mm-hmm. to say a few words, and I had something prepared, but at this point, I changed my plans. I brought the reflector, and I explained to them what I had gone through to be there, and I presented the reflector to them, and I said, I want you to use this to remember you to always protect each other, especially in your darkest hours, as this did for me.
Move over, David Crockett, the man they called the King of the Wild Frontier. I think David Jones is after your title. That is David Jones, honestly, the things we do for love. Thanks for your company here on NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. Do stay with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.